ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back for another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down the road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales about the wrestling industry. And without any further ado, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. How are you today, Ron?
I'm great, Ryan. It's certainly a good day. It's beautiful. I'm sitting down here just visiting in a part of the country that just went through the hurricane, Hurricane Michael, and we talked just briefly about it, but it's just a shocking sight here in the panhandle of Florida. Never seen any devastation like it.
You know, we did talk a little bit about it on the show. We've talked about it off the air. It is something that so many people have experienced lately. And, you know, you and I both have personal experiences dealing with hurricanes and the devastation caused by it. So once again, I guess it's a good time if anyone wants to contribute money to the Red Cross or anyone that's helping out in hurricane-torn areas. Keep that in mind as we enter the holiday season and everyone starts thinking about giving. Keep in mind everyone who really had so much trouble this year with this devastating hurricane season, Ron. But we're returning this week to some stuff that everyone's been wanting to hear about. You know, we've been all over the place lately, St. Louis, Madison Square Garden, but this time we're going to return to Florida, and we're going to talk a lot about what's going on there.
Yeah, we are. You know, we've been pretty much everywhere. We're all over the country, and we're going to finally talk about a subject that was brought up a couple of weeks ago. In fact, I think a great title for this particular episode would be Fantastic to Finish 1973. You know, that's pretty much saying exactly what this is about. It's a fabulous year. We've started out with a tremendous year in 1973, and we got to just about the end of it without being able to tell this story that happens during the course of 1973. And like I said, I think that those three words are pretty darn descriptive of 1973 in my career. I began in 1973 on my way to Australia for a two-month tour, and then I win the Southern Heavyweight Championship and the Florida Tag Championship when I returned to the United States pretty quickly, as a matter of fact. After coming back, I start becoming a star in St. Louis in 73, wrestle in Madison Square Garden, and then win the Georgia Heavyweight Championship from Cowboy Bill Watts in Atlanta, which is part of the Atlanta Wrestling War story. And it just sounds like a fantastic year, and it is. It was a fantastic year, except that at the same time, I'm getting weary from the road. I'm working too much in the early part of the year. In Australia, I told them when I went there, I'd work every day and all the TVs. And by golly, they put me on all the TVs and they worked my butt off. And then I began to have a mounting number of injuries in the summer, which is par for the course. The more times you're in the ring, the more injuries you're going to have. And by summertime, I'm pretty beat up. And then I start being ignored by the Florida territory in the fall of the year. And I basically kind of burn out, and I get so burned out that I actually start looking for another line of work before the end of the year. I start thinking about, is this what I really want to do? That's kind of crazy, but that's the way it was that year.
You know, one thing you didn't mention, Ron, was money. Were you happy with money in 1973?
Well, obviously, I'm making more money than I ever made in my life as a wrestler or anything else. And it's been a great year monetarily, but sometimes those injuries, you know, when you're hurt, you can look back then, and in that time that you're really in a lot of pain, you start thinking about, you know, well, is this worth it? You know, so it depends on what your injuries are. But I've been in a position where I've been making a tremendous amount of money and had knee injuries and operations and surgeries, and just, you know, I would have given up quite a bit of money not to have that happen to me. So it was a strange circumstance, great year, but I, for the first time, experienced a little bit of burnout and some injuries. It's just a difficult, a little bit of a difficult time. So, you know, those three words, I go really from in 1973 from being fantastic to being finished into something else. And it's a strange event, and I think that's what's going to make a good program for today, is because I want to kind of get into it and really, really explain it.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about all this, Ron, but let's start at the very beginning. Let's break down 1973. How did you go from being on top to looking for another career within 12 months? You did so much. You started the year looking like one of the breakout stars of the NWA, and that's really what you were. You went to Australia. You did all these things. You went to St. Louis. What led to you feeling this way in this 12 months?
Well, let's just take it. Let's take it a step at a time here. Let's break down the year. You know, in January and February, I'm doing great. I'm loving every day. I'm in Australia, but I'm working far too many matches. I'm flying every day and spending nights in hotels. I'm not spending much time with my family, who I took over there with me, expecting to be able to spend some time with them. And I'm starting to accumulate some nagging injuries. They're not major injuries, just little small things that over time turn into bigger things. Because when you wrestle and you get injured, you start protecting your body and you start having injuries on the opposite side of your body. You got a bad arm on the left side, you're trying to protect that shoulder, the left side, and you're going to end up hurting your right side. And it just starts to turn into something more than that. Now, when I come home, I win, obviously, two titles in basically 7 months period of time. But I defend them too often. You know, I defended that Southern Heavyweight Championship a record number of times, and just too much of it. And all those hard matches, the additional injuries, and the travels all adding up. And now you throw in St. Louis. I start going to St. Louis, and I'm even wrestling. I'm wrestling stiffer, pardon the pun, stiffer competition. I'm wrestling guys that can really hurt you in certain ways. And you've got to really be careful when you're working with the bigger guys and guys that are capable of doing things that smaller guys can't do. I'm getting a few worse injuries, and I have even more plane flights and nights away from home and the family. In Madison Square Garden. Now, that's a great honor. I worked Madison Square Garden in the fall of the year, but that comes with a great pressure, you know, and the pressure is to have the great matches and in the venues that takes me out of my Florida home territory again. I'm not in Florida. I'm on the road in St. Louis a lot. So this is beginning to affect my drawing ability in Florida, and that affects my status with the booker, obviously, and reduces my number of bookings and amount of money that I'm going to make. You spoke about money. It's going to hurt me money-wise because the booker can't use me like he was using me because I'm only available 3 or 4 days a week. By the time I win the Georgia title from Bill Watts just before Christmas, I've been so concerned that I've already gotten my Florida real estate license. I'm looking at, you know, this is too much. I can't do it. And do I really want it? I start asking myself all these questions. Now I get that real estate license, and then I start another business to make fiberglass septic tanks for new homes that are being built in the South Florida area. I mean, I'm jumping all around, and I'm lost as a young guy. I've never been this pushed, and I've never been over like I'm getting over. And it's kind of hard for me to adjust to all this.
Let's go back to injuries. How did you handle all your injuries?
Well, you know, we're going to get to a little bit of that. You know, actually, You know, that's a really good question, because a lot of fans don't have any idea what you do with injuries when you're a wrestler. I mean, I'm wrestling in the 1970s, and wrestlers are back in those days, and I assume now, I don't know how Vince handles it with his guys, but when you're a wrestler, you're 100% responsible for any injuries you receive. So that's anything from stitches in your head to broken bones or surgery, if you need it. You know, very few promoters or owners felt any obligation to assist you. It just wasn't done back in those days. You got hurt, you were responsible for finding yourself a doctor, going to hospital, whatever it is, paying for your hospital stay. You didn't get much. When I started promoting in Knoxville, I felt sorry for guys because I had been through that as a wrestler and not a promoter. And when some of my guys got injuries back in those days, in fact, the case of Joe LeDuc ended up in a hospital after the Mongolian Stomper broke the concrete block on his head on TV. And that sent him to the hospital. He was there for almost a week. And I paid his hospital bill because I felt like it was too much to ask of a guy who really wanted to do that. And I didn't even really want that ankle to happen because I anticipated somebody might get hurt. But I paid for his hospital bill, and I'm sure most fans aren't aware that that you couldn't get any kind of health insurance back in those days if you told them you were a wrestler, because one of the first questions they ask you is what's your career, what do you do for a living, and you know, if you tell them you're a wrestler, that made you prone to injuries, big injuries, small injuries, all types of injuries. They didn't cover you. They would they would say right then, I'm sorry, but we can't cover you. You're a wrestler. So you're kind of pretty much on your own when it came to getting hurt. You had to take care of it yourself. And it's not like being on a team of some kind, like a professional football team or any other team, that when you get hurt, they're going to pay for it. And they got trainers and they have physicians, and those physicians are and those trainers are working on you and help you to rehab after you get a significant type of injury. But as a wrestler, you got to rehab yourself. You don't know what to do in rehab sometimes, but you got to pay for it. If you want that advice, if you want that, you have to pay somebody for it and get that. And it just was expensive. It was out of pocket. And you know, if you got a bad injury and you're off for months and months, you have a hard time even surviving. It was a really nasty situation to be hurt as a wrestler in those days.
And all your flights and hotels and all your trans, that was out of pocket as well, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Back in those days, you're responsible for handling everything. You handled, not only did you handle the pay of that, but you had to set up your own flights, and you had to book your own hotels. And some territories would pay for your flights, like St. Louis would pay for your flight in there. They didn't pay for my hotel room, but there were some other territories that occasionally pay for your hotel room. But you were always responsible for booking it yourself. And if you had problems en route, you left too late in the day and you had to change planes somewhere and something happened to your flights or whatever, and you did not make the show, you had to pay for the ticket. And then you didn't get a payoff, which that cost you money, obviously, because you missed the show. And because that's just the way business was. You didn't show up. The promoter had to pay somebody else to take your place. And then he suffered an even worse loss by having an important part of his event not showing up for the fans that paid to see them. So, you know, the fans came to see a particular guy and that guy doesn't show up and you got a big sellout crowd. And, you know, so as a promoter, you don't have much sympathy for the guy that doesn't show up. So if you're a top guy and you're on your game, you're making your flight reservations for early in the day for every event, just in case something goes wrong. You got weather. You got so many things that can happen when you're flying from coast to coast. And you had to give yourself the best chance you could of making that match.
You mentioned earlier the pressure of the sport and the responsibility of having a great match. Tell us more about that.
Well, there's all kinds of different kinds of pressure that come with the responsibility of being on top, being a main eventer. If you're on the first match and you don't make a card, it's not that bad a deal. But if you're in the main event or you're up in the top matches, that's a big thing to not show up. So you've got the pressure of you've got to go out there and have a great match. That's one of certain big amount of pressure. And it makes no difference who you're with. You want to have a great match every night. The pressure you create upon yourself is because you're young, like I was at that time. You're young and nervous about your match throughout the day. Sometimes you're nervous about a match 2 or 3 days before that you have in front of you. And then you got the pressure of working with an injury because you're going to be hurt. And you can't hold back. You can't go out there and have a bad match and not give 100% or more than 100%. If you're hurt, you got to work harder than you normally would. So, and you're in the main event, you got to give it your all. And that pressure of all of that is it's really a difficult thing. It was really hard to adjust to that pressure because you just weren't used to it. I'll give you an example, which this probably really kind of give people an idea. At this point, I'm 25 years old, and I've been working for less than 3 years. And I wake up in the morning in West Palm Beach, Florida. I've got a swollen knee that I twisted in the night. Now, this has actually happened to me. I twisted a knee the night before in Jacksonville, Florida. Then I drove by myself 3 hours back to West Palm, and obviously in great pain. What happens when you drive a car is you can't straighten out your legs, obviously. And I got long legs anyway at 6'9". So my knees would swell so bad, and my knee got so swollen that the next morning I couldn't hardly straighten my leg out. And I know that when I get up that morning, that within 12 hours, I'm going to be getting in the ring in St. Louis for a main event title shot with one of the toughest men alive, a former world champion and the present Missouri heavyweight champion, Gene Kuninski. At that point, I'm not smart about booking that early morning flight. This is young, and I'm young in my career. I didn't book an early morning flight. I get set up on the leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon from West Palm Beach, Florida, and go through Atlanta. I check on the weather, and it's snowing in St. Louis. And then even worse, I check and find out it's snowing in Atlanta. And if you've ever been through the Atlanta airport back in the old days, this is before the new airport, then it's just impossible to get through Atlanta. You're lucky to get through Atlanta on time if they've got tremendous weather, beautiful day. So I know then I have two planes to catch. I got to get there on time, and I have to change planes in Atlanta in a snowstorm, and I have an 80-minute change time, just less than an hour and a half. And I got this swollen knee that's hobbling me. I can't walk very fast because the knee is still swelled, and I'm trying to get there and be able to work on that knee as best I can. And I'm flying out of one of the largest airports in the world. If you've ever been into Atlanta, there's a lot of walking in Atlanta between you change planes. Sometimes you change airlines, and that was the case in this day. I changed airline. So it was really tough. And I know that if I miss that flight, I'm probably not going to make the show. And if I don't make the show, I've got a worthless ticket. I'm going to buy this ticket myself. They're not going to pay me for the ticket. I'm going to lose the big payoff that I was expecting that I would get from a main event match for the Missouri title with a guy like Gene Kuninski. And how long will it take me then to get that high on a St. Louis card again? That's what was really concerning me. So if you put all those things together and you've got about 10 hours or 12 hours of that before you get there, that's pressure. And that's pressure all day long. And it's hard to describe that type of, how do you do handle that type of pressure?
What is it like being on the road with a good distance to go after you get injured, whether it was your knee here or any other injuries throughout your career? When you really get badly hurt and you have a long way to go, what's that like, being on the road and having to drive in that condition?
Oh, gosh. Well, now we drive most of the time back in those days. So, you know, some injuries are not so bad. You know, you got an upper torso injury, you're sitting in a car, it's not so bad. But anything below the waist, any knees, any type of leg injury in which you had to keep your leg bent and ride in a car for an extended period of time. If you were working out of Tampa and you were booked in Miami, you had a 4-hour drive there. You wrestle and you got a 4-hour drive home. You're going to be 8 hours in that car that day. If you leave Tampa and you've got a bad knee and you can't straighten it out by the time you get to Miami, you've got quite a bit of swelling. And then you work on it. And by the time you get back in that car, and you make that 4-hour trip back, and now it's really swollen. You're just hoping that you're going to be able to get up the next day and somehow be able to manage to get in that car and go again. It was really terrible, terrible, painful, just horribly painful. As time went on, I started getting the bad knee injuries, and I dealt with it. I would go to doctors and have them drain my knees. And I had one doctor that I went to see quite a bit, and he would always drain my knee. And then he would say to me, he knew I was a wrestler, and he would say, "Now, Ron, I don't want you to wrestle for 2 weeks. I don't want you on this leg at all for 2 weeks and come back and see me." And I'd say, "Okay, doc." And I would wrestle that night. I would just leave there, sometimes go get in my car and drive for 3 hours and wrestle. And then the next morning when he opened his door, I'd be sitting there and my knee would be bigger than it was the day before. And he would go, "Ron, what did you do?" And I go, "Well, I went to wrestle." And he would go, "Oh my gosh," he would just berate me like hell and say, "You're stupid. What are you doing, man? You're going to, you know," it was just and it was the same thing. And then he would drain it. And then he would say, "Ron, 2 weeks, no ring, 2 weeks." And next day, I'm out there again. It was just what you had to do to make a living, and it was part of the deal. It was part of the sport. Guys became accustomed to being injured and going out there and being able to perform in spite of it.
We will return with more of the Studcast, including the long-teased story about how you came very close to leaving professional wrestling. But first, a word about what is going on this holiday season in the stud store at tnstud.com. Listen to this right now.
Studcast fans, it's Christmas time, and the stud store is open at tnstud.com. Surprise your friends or family members this Christmas with a cool Studcast t-shirt or a personally autographed photo from the stud himself to them or you if you want one. Plus, for the first time ever offered, the just released original Southeastern and Continental Wrestling television show series from the 1980s. Find it at Old School Pro Wrestling DVDs.com. That's Old School Pro Wrestling DVDs.com. Click on new releases and find them there. These legendary DVDs will take you back to the days when wrestling was really wrestling. Get a single historic show for only $8 plus shipping, or this introductory special offer of a 5-disc pack with 4 TV shows and a Ron Fuller special that's never been seen before. Only $39.99 plus shipping. That's a savings of $10. And that's not all. Order before Christmas, and you get 2 free personally autographed photos of Ron Fuller and his brother, Robert, added to the 5-pack. That's a $70 value for only $39.99 plus shipping. This series is a gift that keeps on giving at www.oldschoolprowrestlingdvds.com. That's oldschoolprowrestlingdvds.com. Click on new releases and find them. Order now for your personal piece of wrestling history.
Well, Ron, the listeners could hear more about that at the end of the program, but let's get right back to the story here. We've been waiting a few weeks to find out a little bit more about what made you so unhappy. What led to your decision to try something else? You had a very successful 3-year period in the business. What was going on?
Well, Brian, I guess I've kind of already started talking about it in a way. We've covered a few of the things that go into this whole process. And, you know, that's a great story. This is a very good story, and it's history filled. It's not only about myself or other wrestlers. This is about something that's going on that happens to the entire country in 1973. And that event is it's the oil embargo of 1973. And I guess this is going to be a great history lesson for some of my younger Studcast fans out there that never experienced this. And for those people that do remember it, they'll never forget it. I can guarantee you that. It was a bad time for our country. The 70s were a tough decade for America. And the oil embargo all took place because of the Arab-Israeli war. The Israelis and the Arabs got into it, and we backed, obviously, Israel. And when we did that, the Arabs, who had been providing us with most of our oil, we were very dependent upon their oil, they pulled the rug out from underneath us and said, no more oil. We're not going to sell you any more oil. It was really a really tough time for everybody. I thought there was a much more to the oil. Actually, oddly enough, I thought there was a lot more to the oil embargo than just the fact that this war was going on and the Arabs wanted to influence America to drop their support of Israel. And they figured that we would just bow down and roll over and that would be the end of it and they would have their way. So, Brian, do you remember much about that 73, the oil embargo?
I know about it, sure. I mean, it's one of the two big oil crises, within a decade. But, I'm really curious about how that affected you with this whole story here. So you mentioned that you thought more was going on than just with the Arabs, I believe you said. What else do you think was going on with the oil embargo?
Well, now this is just my thinking, but I really had a belief that, gas stations were totally different in the country prior to this event than after the oil embargo was over. Some younger people maybe freak out at this, but they used to pump your gas. They won't believe this, but they used to pump your gas, clean your windshield, and they'd check your oil for you for free. When you pulled up to a pump. And the only charge for gas back in those days was about 35 cents a gallon, as I remember. And there were the major oil companies that had thousands of stations, obviously, all across the country. And then there's hundreds of those independent stations, independent oil companies, and they own stations of their own. Now, the Arabs, through the OPEC, that was the Organization of Petroleum and Exporting Countries, cut off the sale of oil to America. And it was our own fault. We became dependent upon their oil because back in those days, we were prohibiting drilling. And those people that had oil in the ground in West Texas didn't want to pump it out because gas and oil was so cheap that it made no sense. They sat there on it. They thought about it and said, well, we'd be idiots to pump this oil out of the ground now and get nothing for it. And we might be able to, down the road, get three or four times, which actually probably happened, but if we just leave it in the ground. So when the Arabs pulled the carpet out from underneath us and they stopped that shipment of oil, then it just really, really puts us all in a big jam. And what happens is you start sitting in these lines in gas stations. You can't get gas. Some days you just can't get gas at all. And you can go sit in the line in a station that might take you 4 hours, and you get to the pump, and they put the sign on the pump that says, we're out of fuel. So it was a bad time for America. It was a terrible time to be a wrestler because wrestlers traveled. They ran the roads, and you had to have gas to get to your town. And it was just a horrible situation for the country and for wrestlers in particular.
How did it affect wrestlers in particular?
Well, what you had to do is you had to get a full tank of gas when you had the opportunity. Let's say you were in Tampa and you were going to wrestle in Miami. You had to you had to get a tank of gas if you were lucky, and then you had to think about it, that here's what's going to happen in this trip. I'm going to get down there to Miami, and I'm not going to have enough gas to get back to Tampa. It's going to be dark, and at night, I can't go sit in a station somewhere. I'll miss my match and wait on gas so that I can get back home. It created a real, real stressful situation. Talk about pressure again. That was quite a bit of pressure right there. So instantly what happened is gas prices went from 35 cents a gallon to a dollar. They tripled overnight. And what happened is all of a sudden these attendants that would pump your gas for you and clean your windshield, they're gone. You don't see them anymore. I mean, the things are changing real quick, like at service stations all across America. No more pumping your gas, no more cleaning your windshield. Now everything became self-service. You had to go pull in there and pump your own gas and clean your own windshield, or check your own oil, whatever it was. And the prices were three times as much for the gas you was buying. So it was unbelievable what the struggle it was to pay. And wrestlers were always complaining. Guys were like, wait a minute, you know, I used to be able to go to Miami for $15, and now I'm going to Miami for $45 just for the gas. The deal was that everybody was making it look like the oil was all not coming because of OPEC. But I lived down there close to Miami, and I remember going to the beach in Miami and seeing these oil tankers anchored up, you know, 2, 3, 4 miles offshore. And I would ask people there, you know, people that were there all the time, I'd say, how long's that tanker been out there? What is he waiting on? And they go, I think he's loaded with gas. And I'm with oil, you know, that's going to make gas, obviously, when he brings it in. And I got to thinking, now, what the hell is going on? So I believe, this is my thinking, that the major oil companies in America wanted to take over the gasoline and oil business in America. And they had all these independent stations. And what they decided they needed to do was starve those independents out. And I think those major oil companies had bought that gas. That gas was their gas. But if they brought it in, it would end up being sold to some of these independent stations. There were thousands of independent stations across America. And these major companies said, if we can put these guys out of business, we'll be able to charge for gasoline whatever we want to charge. And that's my opinion. That's what I think happened to America during that time frame. The major oil companies squeezed out and starved out the independents. And when they got full control, I still think to this day, Brian, in my opinion, that you pay a gas price that's decided on about by someone that belongs in a group of major oil distributors. Because why is it, if you look today, back in those days, you would see a major oil station, a service station, would be charging 35 cents, and there would be an independent two blocks away charging 25 cents. And now everybody's price is the same. When you go buy gasoline, if you look around, everybody's charging the same price. Yeah, that could not happen if they weren't working together. I think they were working together then, and I think they're still working together.
You know, in New Jersey, it's mandatory full service, legally mandated full service, where I don't have to get out of the car. Any gas station you go to in New Jersey, they come over and they take care of it.
Well, that's amazing, you know, because down here in the Florida area, in the Tennessee area, everybody's gas price is within 2 or 3 cents of each other. You don't see any of the independent stations like there used to be back in the 70s. You wouldn't even recognize the names of some of the companies, but you knew they were independent. They're not owned by Exxon or Shell or right, whatever companies, right. The major companies like that. So, You know, and when you went to, there was, the situation was so bad. So let's take that example of that trip to, from Tampa to Miami to wrestle down there. You had to make arrangements to get gasoline there. And the way you did it, guys would have fans that, you know, that came to see them and talk to them every week at the matches. They would get their phone numbers and call them up on a Wednesday when they were driving down to Miami, and they would say, hey, can you do me a big favor? Can you go to a gas station, take 2 5-gallon gas cans, and get me $10 worth of gas so that I can make it back home to Miami? And you would see it in exchange that time in this country. I would see on Wednesday nights guys taking 5-gallon gas cans and putting it into the tanks of their car to be able to make it back to Miami. And then you didn't just do it one day. You did it every day. You did it the next day. If you were going to go to Jacksonville, you had the same type of arrangement with some fans in Jacksonville that helped you out. It was a real strange time to be living in America. And then what happened then is they took it even further. They had to, because the freeways were running 75. I remember having 75 mile an hour speed limits on freeways in Tennessee, and all of a sudden the entire nation went to 55 miles an hour. Everybody had to slow down. Well, obviously that was so they would consume less fuel, but at the same time for wrestlers, that's a real blow, man. We were accustomed to running at 70, 80 miles an hour, trying to get there, leave as late as possible, drive as fast as possible, and get there. And it just changed everything for everybody. It was a very, very strange time for America, and it's just it was an experience to have lived through that 73 oil embargo.
And I think we can all agree that it is time for them to raise the speed limit back to 75 once again, but we'll get to that at another time. Ron, let's get back to wrestling. You still haven't told us exactly what made you so unhappy.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of drawing it out here because, I think people are going to be a little bit amazed with how this all breaks down. But so obviously in 73, I'm having a great year. But it hasn't made me happy. I've accomplished a lot. I'm questioning the fact now is this wrestling life really for me? Because you got all types of different pressures here, and I got championship belts and fame, and that's all wonderful. But they come with a price and a lot of sacrifice. I'm doing great in the ring, but my home life and my health are suffering because of what I'm doing for a living. I think this happens to a hell of a lot of wrestlers at some point in their career. It's hard to balance the success and in the sport and your private life and to figure out what really means the most to you. It's difficult to decide what actually works and what actually doesn't work. Is this worth it? Are these injuries worth it? Is this travel worth it? Is this being away from your family worth it? There's a lot of different elements here that make such a difference in the what goes on. So in 73, I'm taking off from the sport of wrestling, but I feel like I'm about to crash at home. That's a horrible feeling. I mean, my wrestling, my money is great. I look at my towns that I'm in and who I'm wrestling, and I'm certainly getting to the top. But at the same time, when I get home, my wife is going, gosh, man, you've been gone for a week. And there were times in which I would be gone all week long. I would spend 3 days in St. Louis. I would spend 2 days in Atlanta. I would spend a day in another city that's out of the territory. And I might not get home for an entire week. So obviously, things seem to be going well on the surface, but there's a lot of holes beneath. There's a lot of things happening that aren't good. I've been in the territory for 3 years at this point. I come in the fall of 1970, and then now it's the fall of 1973, and things have been going well, but it's too long. I've been here for 3 years. I should have been looking for someplace else to go. I had... If I hadn't been sent to West Palm to run West Palm in 1971, I think I would have probably already been gone from Florida, and I would have been working another territory somewhere, like Carolina, which I never worked. And I always wished I had gone to work for Crockett. Crockett Sr. was still there at that point, to go and work in that territory, because so many great wrestlers came out of that territory. So I'm spending all this time in St. Louis, and it, you know, I'm not being effective anymore in Florida. I'm not making the Florida TVs sometimes, and I'm not as high up on the cards in late 73 as I was in the early part of the year before I started going to St. Louis. So, and you know, when you're a booker, it's difficult to book a guy on top that's not available for you every night. When you get a guy over, you need to use him while he's hot. And Louis Tillette was the booker, and at that time he only had, I only was, like I said, about 4 days a week. That's all he could get for me. And because I was everywhere else, he got to where he was just not booking me very much. And so I'm working, you know, almost every night. In the first part of the year in 1973, I look back at my sheet, and I worked 70 times in the first 74 days after I came back from Australia. I had 4 days off in 74 days. That's almost 3 months. When I started working steadily in St. Louis, Louis had to focus on getting someone else over, and he started cutting my bookings back. During the fall of 73, only 6 months later, I work only 16 times in 70 days in Florida. And I actually am off 40 days during that 70 days. So obviously, I'm beginning to really question if they wanted me here, or do they really want to use me in Florida anymore? And do I really need to go somewhere else? So that was a difficult decision to make.
I want to ask you a little bit about that, but first let me take a step back. You talked a little bit about the question, is it worth it? You obviously come from one of the biggest, if not the very biggest, wrestling family of all time. To the best of your knowledge, anyone else in your family ever asked themselves that question? Is it worth it?
Yes, absolutely. My father did it on many occasions. When I was a young boy, when I was a baby, he went to Roy sent him to run the Tri-Cities in the eastern part of Tennessee. That's Johnson City, Kingsport, and Bristol, Tennessee. He went directly from there down to Mobile. Then when he got to Mobile, after a couple of years of really great success establishing Gulf Coast Wrestling in Mobile, he bought a farm. And he started spending a lot of time on the farm, and he really neglected his time spent on building his business anymore. And later on, we leave there, we go to Memphis, he works hard, and then he buys another farm, a big farm right in the edge of Memphis, that actually Elvis Presley was vying with him to buy it. They both wanted the property and the big home that was on it. And Dad, I guess, spent more money on it than Elvis was willing to. And but then he wanted to, after that, he wanted to go farm. He wanted to quit, you know. And I used to say, well, Dad, why aren't you wrestling anymore? And he would just say, you know, I don't know, kid. It don't seem right now, you know. And I guess that was his way, without explaining it to me, of saying what was going on. It happened to him for his entire career. It seemed like he had great success in Memphis. We became farmers. We had to leave the farm because farming was very difficult, and you don't make a lot of money farming. And he had to go back into wrestling. We start going to Arizona. He goes to Arizona twice. He goes there once. We live in Tucson for about 8 months. He gets that thing rocking, and he gets disenchanted with being in wrestling. And he says, let's go back to the farm. We go back to Mississippi. We farm for another 6 or 8 months. We go back to live in Phoenix, back into the same territory that has fallen apart while he was gone because people didn't know how to run it. He builds it back. He says, when we go, he says, we're going to go there. We're going to make a certain amount of money. And when we get to that, we're going to come back here. We'll stay here and be farmers forever. I think that's what he really wanted to do. And we did. We made the big money in Phoenix. We came back on the farm, and we had to leave the farm and go to Mobile. It just continually happened. So I guess maybe some of that thinking that I'm going through at this point came from being around my father and seeing his. It was like he loved it being a wrestler, and he loved this building of a territory and making fans out of people, out of a place that could never draw fans. I think all of that was a challenge to him. But when he accomplished it and he started getting these big sellouts and these huge crowds, he lost his interest and he wanted to go back to be whatever it was, a farmer or whatever it was at that point again.
Let's go back to Louis Tillette, the booker. You said he had lost confidence in you, or at least you thought he did. Why did you feel that way?
Well, you know, I guess that's only natural. You're a young guy and you're in the sport and you've been pushed pretty good. And you start when you get jerked back in the fall of 73, I'm not getting booked anymore. And my first thought is, well, maybe Louis thinks that I'm just not the talent that he thought I was 6 months ago. I don't think that was really the case. He was put in a position because I was running these St. Louis trips where he couldn't use me as well. So, and Louis turns out to be a great guy for me when I get to Southeastern Wrestling in 74 and I formed that company. He's the very first booker I hire is Louis Tillette because he's a great booker. I needed someone to help me get the business off the ground. He does a pretty decent job of it. Later on, my brother's going to come in, take over that job and really blow it away. Just really does a fabulous job. But when I change then, when I go to Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola and I buy out the Fields brothers with Gulf Coast Wrestling and I change the name to Southeastern Wrestling, this is years later, 5 years later, first guy I bring is Louis again. So Louis and I have a great relationship. We have a lot of respect for each other. But he just seems to be the guy I bring back again and again. He never lost confidence in me. I think I lost confidence in myself.
How do you regain confidence?
Well, that's, you know, that's a good question, too. I guess, you know, I did not, at this point, I was so overwhelmed by the year that I had had and my injuries and my time away from my family. And I was pushing basically to leave wrestling. I couldn't see that I wasn't happy with it. I was getting those thoughts that my dad got all the time. And I did some strange things. You know, I got my Florida real estate license because I thought, hey, you know, with the real estate's pretty hot and it's in Florida. And obviously there's going to be millions of people over the next 30 years that's going to come to Florida and a lot of homes being sold and that type of stuff. And I did some crazy stuff, different things. For instance, I had a buddy there that was in the construction business We had a conversation one night just out of, you know, we're sitting around having a beer together. And he says, Ron, you know, have you ever thought about septic tanks in this part of the country? He goes, if you don't live in a city and you live outside of town and there is no sewer lines that run by your home, you have to buy a septic tank. And so I was like, well, how much does a septic tank cost? I mean, I started asking a few questions and he said, well, you know, this is about $800 for a builder. And he said, but you can't build a home without it. Because it's a requirement. Obviously, you can't run your sewage out into your backyard, you know, so you have to put it someplace. So I said, well, how do you make it? And we got into a long discussion, probably spent 3 or 4 hours that night. And he and I decided, he says, let's start a septic tank company. Let's build our own septic tanks. And that really intrigued me because I thought, you know, there's got to be a future in that. And at this point, I'm very disenchanted with wrestling. I'm ready to leave it. And I think, well, you know, this could really work. So there we are. We start into this, into building septic tanks. You build septic tanks out of fiberglass, and we've made some molds up for septic tanks, and we built 20 septic tanks, and everything looked really rosy. We sold those 20 septic tanks 2 days after we finished building the 20th one. We sold all 20 at $800 a pop. We had a $16,000 day. And I was like, wow, man, this is big time. You know, this has got wings. You know, I'll make more money doing this than I would have made wrestling. And then it happened.
What happened?
Then it happened. The 73 OPEC.
Oh, yeah.
That's what happened. It just really knocked the bottom out of our little idea. Because what happened is, you just as gas was hard to get, so was resin. And that's how you made septic tanks, is with resin. And that was a byproduct of oil. And now, all of a sudden, we've just made our first big sale, a $16,000 sale. And 2 days later, we roll over to the place where we're buying our resin, and we run in there and go, yeah, we want to give us 10 barrels of 10 55-gallon drums of resin. And the guy goes, no, I don't think so. And we're like, what do you mean, no? You know, well, you know where what's going on with the oil and all that. And we're not making resin. They're not making resin anymore. So we're like, what do you mean they're not making? They're just not. Nobody is going to make resin. You're probably not going to be able to get resin to shoot fiberglass with until the oil embargo is over. So we was like feast or famine. We went from flying to dying. Just right there on and 1 5-minute conversation, and that was out. That was gone. Septic tank business was gone.
Well, let's get back to wrestling here. Obviously, I didn't know this story, and this explains why you walked away from wrestling. You were about to become a septic tank millionaire if things had worked out differently. But when you look at the results, one thing that stands out is that you all of a sudden, randomly, I shouldn't say randomly, but you all of a sudden appear in Atlanta. And you win the Georgia championship from Bill Watts, like you mentioned, and then you're back in Florida. So you weren't even full time in Atlanta. What was the story there? What happened?
What happened is a lot of things were going on. Obviously, the war had just begun. The Atlanta Wrestling War had just begun, and Ann's starting to run there, and Watts is there, and Watts has been there, and so Watts is going to make a move from Florida. From Georgia down to book in Florida. And during this time frame, I'm not being used hardly at all. He's aware of that. There were other guys in the Florida territory, tremendous talents that weren't being used. Hiro Matsuda is an example. So Hiro and I are available, but we're not getting many bookings. I'm still doing some St. Louis stuff, but I'm not getting booked very much in Florida. Now, I go in and work that match. Watts doesn't want to put over Mr. Wrestling number 2. And for some reason, he picks me as the guy that he will put the strap on. So I fly into Atlanta. I work with Watts. And I don't expect I don't know Watts at that point is even coming to Florida. I'm not privy to that type of information. That's Eddie and Dad's conversations. So I think, you know, this is just a one-time deal and nothing's going to develop out of this. But then Watts loved the match we had. And he saw that I was a big guy and that I could work with him. And I guess he figured I could work with other guys too. And so Watts calls me up. When I go back home, I'm thinking, you know, they booked me again. They say, Ron, you're going back in 2 weeks. You're going to drop the title to Wrestling 2. And that basically I figure, well, that's the end of my Georgia run. You know, I won't be probably going back after that at all. And out of the clear blue, Watts calls me up and he says, Ron, I really loved the match that we had, and I see you as having a great deal of talent, and I see that he tells me, he's the first one to tell me, he says, I'm coming there to book and I want to use you. And he said, in fact, I want to use you. I want to be partners with you. And he was a heel. I don't know if he'd been a babyface. And he said, I want to be a babyface partner with you. And then down the road, I'm going to turn on you. And he says, I'll make you a lot of money. And that's how things changed. And now we're rolling into 1974, first week in 1974, first week or two, I go back to Atlanta, I drop that title, and I come back to Florida. Watts is there. All of a sudden, I start getting back on the Florida cards, and things just are going to go crazy there. And it's just it's a remarkable thing how things happen. It's just pretty remarkable that I went from really thinking I'm done and I'm finished with it, I don't want it anymore, to right back in it, maybe stronger than ever in 1974.
So that's the story. That's why Bill Watts always says he got you back into the business when you were going to quit.
That's it. And that's exactly how it happened. He knows. I don't think I've ever told Bill Watts the septic tank story.
Really?
I don't believe he knows that my intentions were to quit. In fact, I'm sure he didn't, because I never told him, and I never told the story, but to a few people. And it changed my life. He took me from dropping wrestling and moving away from what my family had done for generations, and threw me right back in the middle of the mix and made me a happy camper. And later on, from there, I'm going to take it to buying my own territory and to making a lifetime career out of something that I was just about to walk away from.
Obviously, you talked about you and Louie earlier. Was there anyone else in the office that had an issue with you at the time? Was everything cool with you and Eddie that led to this period before Bill Watts got there where you were getting so few bookings?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, I spent a lot of time with Eddie, and Eddie was treated me just like he always had. Obviously, I wasn't having problems with my dad. I don't know. I think really Louie did not do it intentionally. I think Louie's a businessman, and he's responsible for drawing houses, and he's responsible for putting the best talent he can in the ring, because if he doesn't, he's not going to draw houses. And my availability wasn't there. He probably saw the potential I had. Obviously, he did. He booked some of those matches in which I end up winning championships. So he saw the potential I had, but he couldn't push me because I wasn't available enough to be pushed. And I never got upset with Louie about it. I didn't think it was a personal thing. I just thought maybe, you know, when you're in a position like that and you've been used very well and all of a sudden things start to change, you figure that it's either time to go. And in my case, I thought not this is a time to go to another territory. It may be time to go to another career. And I kind of pushed it to an extreme to say, I'm going to get out of it entirely.
Well, we're all glad you stayed, Ron. Of course, because you stayed, we have the Studcast each and every week. But as we wrap things up, I know you have something you want to tell the listeners a little bit about.
Something is going on that, I'm going to explain this to fans. When we ran wrestling at Southeastern in Pensacola and with Continental, we did not save tapes. We covered our tapes up. We just used them again and again and again. We never saved a library of wrestling shows. And when I left wrestling, I did not have a library of wrestling shows to sell. And if I had of, I don't think it would have been worth anything at that point in the 80s to be selling your program, because you're probably not going to get it used someplace else anyway. So we lost that potential income. But then, as a strange event happened, we found a gentleman in England that had copies of all of our Southeastern, just about everything from 84 all the way to 88. Some Southeastern, and then when it switched over to Continental with Gordon Solie doing the commentary, many years of it, maybe 4 or 5, close to 5 years of wrestling shows that have never, ever been shown in a format of a CD. So, I mean, you can see them, some of them on YouTube, but we've found these. We've been working on it for many months. We're ready to release what I call the Lost Territory, Southeastern and Continental Wrestling, the Lost Territory, because it was lost. People didn't know about it. There wasn't that much you could see on it. We had all this great talent and all these young guys that went on to become stars, Hulk Hogan, Honky Tonk Man, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, Arn Anderson. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Now we have these tapes, and we're going to start selling them to people that have a demand. The demand out there, we ran a little ad just finding out what the demand was. It was just astronomical, the demand. So what we've done is we're setting up a website, and you can go to that website. You'll be able to order Continental, Southeastern, and Continental Television wrestling shows. They're going to come in the package. You can order a single show for $8. You pay the shipping. Or you can get a 5-pack for $39.99. That's $8, basically, for each one of those CDs. And you can get that if fans are interested in getting this and seeing the actual Continental and Southeastern wrestling shows as they were done originally. Great quality. These are all great quality. And they're basically the Lost Territory. That's what I call these tapes, is the Lost Territory, because most people have never seen them. And, you know, you're going to see Hulk Hogan before he was Hulk Hogan, and you'll see Brutus Barber Beefcake when he was before that. You'll see Arn Anderson before he became his star. It's just going to be a tremendous opportunity for fans around the country and all over the world to get these. And if you're interested in this, for Christmas, actually, we're going to, if you buy one of the 5-packs for $39.99, you're going to get an autographed, personalized autographed photo from me and Rob that will be free, that will be included into that 5-pack CD all the way up until at least Christmas. So if you order before Christmas, you'll get those two photos along with it. And you can find that at www.oldschoolprowrestlingdvds.com. That's www.oldschoolprowrestlingdvds.com. And you just click on new releases, and they'll take you right there to New Continental, the Continental Wrestling, and the Southeastern Wrestling television programs from the 84 right on through into 88. So that's pretty remarkable thing, that fans are going to have the chance to see it. And I've had so many fans in my lifetime since I got out of wrestling, they said, boy, I would have given anything to see some of those shows. Well, you're going to be able to see some of those. Yeah, I think some of the best wrestling in anywhere in the world, and one of the greatest wrestling shows anywhere in the world. Obviously, with Gordon Solie and guys like that, you've got a quality product. And shot in a live arena from Birmingham, Alabama. And it's I just hope fans will, if you're interested, that's where you go to find it. And I'll talk about it again maybe on Studcast in the future.
We also want to remind you that the Tennessee Stud has 2 Facebook pages, but please do not leave friend requests on Ron Fuller Welch. That page is absolutely full. We cannot add any more people there, but you can like the Stud on Facebook, going to the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, and you will automatically be his friend in that way. So check that out, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We want to remind you once again to visit The Stud Store now at tnstud.com for all of your holiday gifts. The Tennessee Stud, official Studcast t-shirts, autographed photos, and so much more, including every single episode of the Studcast and the Super Studcast. tnstud.com. Of course, on the topic of the Super Studcast, if you are a fan of this show and you want more, and how could you not, you can get additional stud each month by going to either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast and becoming a patron of this show and getting the Super Studcast, two additional hours, and then the rest of the story, a third hour, each and every month only, $2.99. And of course, we have another big Super Studcast coming at you on Tuesday, December 11th. Stay tuned for an announcement on that, which will be coming in the days ahead. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we've gotten out of wrestling and we've gotten back into wrestling. So we're going to go back to St. Louis. We're going to have a world championship match with Harley Race in St. Louis early in 1974. In the next episode, I'm pretty sure we'll get to the point to where I'm going to win the Florida heavyweight title. And we're going to be entering an era, I'm going to call it the Dusty Rhodes explosion. Dusty is going to turn babyface in Florida, and he is going to create pandemonium in the state of wrestling in Florida. It's going to be phenomenal. So we're going into a new year, 1974. It's going to be a tremendous year, and I'm going to end up ultimately toward the end of 74 starting my very first wrestling company, Southeastern Championship Wrestling in Knoxville.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.